pros and five cons from lawmakers, speak against or in favor of the list.
The reform program pursued by the administration is the centerpiece of the proposed minister's agenda. The program is based on five pivotal points. First, a statement on the second step of the Islamic revolution. Second, improving Islamic and Iranian values. Third, pursuing economic resilience. Fourth, improving the livelihoods of the people, especially low-income families. Fifth, promoting international relations based on national interests.
The process will then involve the introduction of the nominated ministers one by one and based on the Persian alphabetical order of the ministries. For each minister, two pros and two cons will speak, each for 15 minutes, before the nominees take the podium to defend their qualifications for 30 minutes. Majlis says it will work two shifts every day to wrap up the process swiftly.
Parliament maintains a cooperative stance toward the government. We will work two shifts a day to cover up to five nominees every day. If all goes as planned, we will hold the final session on Tuesday.
Ebrahim Raisi handed his proposed cabinet lineup to Parliament 10 days ago, a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators then reviewed the credentials of the proposed ministers behind closed doors for a week. The open floor vote of confidence sessions are expected to run until Tuesday, when the final voting will be held for the 19 ministerial picks.
Lawmakers say in their voting they bear in mind that the proposed lineup is the team that the president wants to work with. And given Raisi's close ties with parliament, it's expected that the majority of the nominees will win the green light to sit on the ministerial chairs. Yusuf Jalali from the Iranian parliament.
The UK government came under immense fire today after MPs condemned the catastrophic British failures in Afghanistan. During Wednesday's parliamentary debate on the subject, Boris Johnson desperately attempted to convince MPs that Britain's withdrawal wasn't chaotic at all, but with little success.
Mr. Speaker, I think it would be fair to say that the events in Afghanistan have unfolded and the collapse has been faster than I think even the Taliban themselves predicted. What is not true is to say that the UK government was unprepared or did not foresee this.
Before the debate even started, anti-war Labour MPs gathered outside Westminster with anti-war veteran Jeremy Corbyn to denounce British foreign policy.
Many of the MPs who have been supportive of the continued war and occupation in Afghanistan will be sitting today during this debate, which has already begun. Now, this will be very awkward for them, as many of the anti-war MPs who have criticised British foreign policy, particularly in Afghanistan for many, many years, have been proven right following the latest developments in Afghanistan.
British military failures was not the only focus of criticism. Concern over the lack of willingness to help Afghan refugees was expressed too. For the time being, the UK is refusing to recognise the Taliban's administration, but have agreed to accept some refugees, but only time will tell if Britain will honour this pledge or not. Robert Carter, London.
Russian President Vladimir Putin and German Chancellor Angela Merkel held talks in the Kremlin. This is their last summit meeting as heads of state because Merkel will not participate in the upcoming parliamentary elections in Germany. Her farewell visit took place on the anniversary of the alleged poisoning of opposition leader Alexei Navalny.
Despite the fact that we have different opinions, I think it is good that we talk to each other and we intend to keep in touch further.
After the meeting with the Russian president, Merkel called on Putin to release Navalny. Putin, however, said the fight against corruption should not be used as an instrument of political struggle, adding the opposition figure was convicted not for his political activities, but for criminal offenses against foreign partners. The two also touched upon the situation in Afghanistan. Putin said Moscow's priority is to prevent terrorists from entering neighboring countries under the guise of refugees.
We know Afghanistan, and we know how this country is organized and how counterproductive it is to try to impose unusual forms of government and public life on it. Any such socio-political experiments have never been successful and led only to the destruction of states, degradation of their political and social systems.
In addition to bilateral relations, the fight against the coronavirus pandemic, the conflict in eastern Ukraine, the situation in Belarus, as well as Nord Stream 2 and the role of Ukraine as a transit country for Russian gas were discussed.
Merkel managed to defend the Nord Stream. The Americans pressed on her. Germany needs Russian energy. Regarding the situation in Afghanistan, here Germany fully listened to what the Americans were saying, and now Germany has received it in full. The Americans are living in an ugly way, having substituted all their allies in the NATO alliance. This once again showed that Germans that it's absurd to rely on the U.S. America's visit shows that the stake on in America is doubtless wrong, and Germany during the reign of Merkel has repeatedly succumbed to influence from overseas.
On August 22nd, Merkel will fly to Kyiv. Putin asked her to influence the country's authorities to fulfill all obligations on Donbas.
Berlin has always been one of Moscow's main partners in politics and economics. The Russian president expressed hope that with the new leadership in Germany, in the near future, it would be possible to continue the dialogue on resolving the conflict in southeastern Ukraine. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Turkey says it will decide on Taliban's government recognition after it is formed. Turkish foreign minister said Ankara will not rush into recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan as it is still too early for this step.
We are keeping up dialogue with all sides, including the Taliban. We view positively the messages that the Taliban have given so far, whether to foreigners, diplomatic individuals, or its own people. We hope to see these in action as well.
In response to a question regarding Turkey's contact with the Taliban, Çavuşoğlu said Turkey had invited the political wing of the Taliban to Turkey before they had entered Kabul. Earlier, Turkish security sources said Ankara had dropped plans to guard and operate Kabul's airport after the withdrawal of NATO forces from Afghanistan, following footage and reports of chaos taking place there after Taliban's takeover. Turkey says its offer to provide technical and security assistance at the Kabul airport will be further discussed with the U.S.
Turkey will follow the lead of other countries in recognizing a Taliban government in Afghanistan. If the U.S. and EU countries recognize a government formed by Taliban, Turkey will follow in their footsteps. However, I don't think that Turkey will consider the Taliban government as a strategic partner in the region. We expect a delegation from the Taliban to visit Turkey for talks over the transition phase, just like it is taking place with other countries in the region.
The Turkish president had announced last week his readiness to meet with the Taliban leadership. Turkey says so far the Taliban is sending positive messages, hoping that it will be followed with positive actions as well. Turkey is now concerned about the refugee influx it is going to have after Taliban's takeover in Afghanistan. This comes as it has been struggling to revive the economic situation in the country with a handful of refugees already there amid the coronavirus pandemic. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria, dressed in black, marched along major streets beating their chests in mourning over the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, his household, and his loyal companions in Karbala in present-day Iraq. The army of Yazid conducted the massacre in the most brutal manner.
They have shown merciless acts there in that field, in which Imam Hussein and his household, his sahabas, in which they believe in him, and even babies in which they have been born, they have been killed.
Members of the Islamic movement said the Ashura is a time for sorrow and is a time for self-reflection when one commits oneself completely to the mourning of Imam Hussein. They said commemorating the martyrdom in Karbala signifies the ultimate prize in the pursuit of justice and righteousness.
The Ashura teaching, it teaches us to be, at least to be honest on all our believing, to submit all our faith to Almighty Allah. We should not fear any creator in this earth. if we want to fulfill our promise to be a good Muslim or to practice the religion of our Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his descendants the way it is.
According to the Islamic movement, the Ashura processions were conducted peacefully in many Nigerian cities. However, they said two people were killed in the northwestern Nigerian state of Sokoto, where the Nigeria police attacked the procession with live rounds. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Panicked and distressed, Afghans continue to seek refuge in Iran as they face a dim future in their country. As ex-Afghan President Ashraf Ghani fled his country and ceded power to the Taliban, Iran's eastern borders have seen an unabated influx of Afghans who seek a new life in Iran.
This is the Iranian-Afghan border. Afghan refugees who have just crossed into Iran, a country they call a second home.
Some used to be wealthy businessmen who have lost their possessions in the conflict, and others are simply concerned about the future of their children. But all wind up here in this camp, where they have to wait for a decision by Iranian authorities whether to let them in or send them back to their country.
I ask the Iranian government to allow us to stay here until the situation improves in our country. If we were not forced to, we would have not deserted our homeland.
I have nothing to lose. There is no future for me and my children in Afghanistan. I came to Iran as my last hope to build a future for my two kids.
How can I raise my kids in my country? My husband has lost everything. We spent all we have to get to Iran.
Iran's border police have set up makeshift camps alongside the country's eastern border with Afghanistan to temporarily accommodate the inbound refugees. Milak Crossing Point in Sistan and Balochistan is one of the border crossings that has seen the entry of more than 600 Afghans every day since the Taliban began advancing in Afghanistan. The Iranian armed forces say they have received incoming Afghans with open arms, providing them with all the relief items such as masks and disinfectants, food and medicine.
Over the past week, Iran's armed forces have spared no effort to accommodate our Afghan brothers and sisters who have sought refuge in our country. It's our duty first as human beings and then as Muslims who share the same language and culture to offer services to our troubled neighbor.
The collapse of the Afghan army and the government began with U.S. President Joe Biden's implementation of his predecessor's planned troop withdrawal after two decades of presence on the Afghan soil, something which Afghans say has yielded nothing but destruction and bloodshed for their country.
The U.S. invaded our country in 2001 on the pretext of promoting peace and security, but after 20 years, it left us with nothing but misery, poverty, unemployment, and now displacement.
Iran is already home to some 3 million Afghan refugees and economic migrants, the majority of whom are unregistered. Now, with a dream for a bright future, these people hope that Iran's border will separate them from their tumultuous past. Yusuf Jalali from Iran-Afghanistan border.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes to protest the illegal Israeli policy of administrative detention. A total of 10 prisoners are going on with their protests, demanding the occupying regime to either release them or prosecute them. According to their families, Israel is responsible for the lives of the hunger strikers, as many were transferred to jail's military clinics after their health conditions deteriorated, while refusing to allow even their lawyers to visit them.
We know that Mujahid was transferred to the Ramleh military clinic. This means he's in a bad health condition. He has been detained over 1 year ago under administrative detention, while he was not tried in Israeli court and there are no charges against him. He decided to start an open-ended hunger strike after the Israeli authorities renewed his administrative detention for the third time. It is unfair.
Scores of Palestinians, including prisoners, relatives and friends, as well as prisoners' advocacy groups, protested outside the building of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Ramallah in solidarity with the hunger-striking prisoners, as well as with the sick inmates who face medical negligence by the Israeli Prisons Administration, while the health conditions of many of them have seriously deteriorated.
We are here today to send a message that the prisoners are not alone in their battle. We are their voice outside the jail. We are here to support the hunger-striking prisoners and to support the sick prisoners, as a number of prisoners' lives are in danger. On top of those sick prisoners are Ayad Herabat and Nasser Abu Hamid. We are demanding the Red Cross Committee to immediately act and save them because their health is seriously deteriorating.
Administrative detention is illegal. However, it's a tactic that allows Israeli authorities to put Palestinians behind bars indefinitely without charge or trial, claiming they were arrested based on secret reports which are inaccessible to prisoners themselves and their lawyers.
Despite international rejection of administrative detentions, Tel Aviv is pushing with the illegal practice. It continues to trigger more hunger strikes by the Palestinian inmates who say their move is a legitimate means to resist the Israeli policy. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily around the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the name of Allah, the best of the names, in the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, Lebanon has been under economic pressure for at least 2 years now, from major currency devaluation to lack of fuel and electricity. The Lebanese people have been targeted. Now, according to the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, it is the United States which is mostly behind the suffering of the Lebanese people. We'll be talking about what is happening in Lebanon and why. I want to start it off by welcoming our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh. Mariam, well, please fill us in. We heard Sayed Hassan speak tonight. Fill us in on where we are right now in the situation in Lebanon.
Well, it's basically a brief white philosopher's speech today. He was able to highlight the major problem and what the problem is. And although he said that we do have mismanagement, We do have a lot of corruption in the country. However, what we're witnessing right now is a battle. It is a battle being forced upon Lebanon by the U.S., and it is being orchestrated by the U.S. Embassy in Beirut. He did specify and stress that the main reason for the lack of provision, the lack of fuel, the fact that the major companies are not distributing fuel, the fact that even that we have monopolizers, even that is being orchestrated by the U.S. And smuggling of fuel out of the country, smuggling of, as he said previously, smuggling of U.S. dollars outside the country was also orchestrated by the U.S. in order to choke the Lebanese people. And what he stressed on today was the fact that this is not only targeting Hezbollah, it is not only targeting the supporters of Hezbollah and the resistance and all those nationalist people and the patriots in the country, it's also targeting everyone, even those that are the allies or the so-called friends of the U.S., and he also called on them to heed this fact that they will not be gaining anything from all of this. He also highlighted the fact that after Hezbollah's, the Secretary General had declared that a shipment of fuel will be leaving Iran before an Ashura, and today he declared there will be another ship which will be coming into to Lebanon in the coming days. He said that this coincided with promises, which he called empty promises, from the U.S. ambassador here in Beirut, saying that the U.S. will work on negotiating and bringing in funds from the World Bank in order to bring in gas from Egypt through Jordan and Syria. And he said that these are false claims. Why? Because this requires several issues. First of all, it requires that the U.S. Congress itself approve such a movement, because it also requires that the Lebanese government negotiates and holds talks with the Syrian government, which the U.S. Is, of course, prohibiting, in order for the Syrian government to allow that gas to come into Lebanon through its territories. Of course, he spoke about so many issues. There's not enough time to perhaps brief them all, but the major point is that Hezbollah is on their way to bringing in fuel into Lebanon in order to ease the tension, to ease the sanctions. This is something that is perhaps a very major and very close to what we saw in the war in the year 2006. That was considered a major confrontation directly between the U.S. That was a war enforced upon Lebanon by the U.S., of course, through its tools, tool specifically Israel. Now we have another form of a war, which is majorly economic and social, and we see here Hezbollah very clearly confronting, and as the Secretary General said, that they would once again be victorious.
Thank you very much for that update out of Beirut. That's Maryam Saleh. I'd like to welcome now my guest, Spotlight, journalist and political analyst Elijah McNear out of Brussels. And Professor of International Studies at the University of Tehran, Mohammed Manandi, out of Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. I'd like to start this off in Tehran. Mohammed, you heard what Maryam was saying, and of course it was a summary of what the Secretary General has said. Why is it that, first of all, if you agree with the analysis, why is it that the United States would want to see the Lebanese people suffer. What do they want to get out of this?
Well, the United States wants Israel to be able to dominate the territories surrounding it. So they would like to see Egypt as a failed state. They would like to see Jordan as a failed state, and both of them are failed states. And they would like to see Syria, which was a strong country, broken to a degree. They've achieved that. The Syrians, of course, have fought back, and they've been able to defeat much of what the Americans and NATO has thrown at them, the dirty war and Al-Qaeda and ISIS to a large degree, but it has still caused enormous suffering, and now the Americans have imposed sanctions on the Syrians that are an attempt to achieve what they couldn't achieve through the dirty war. The same is true with Lebanon. The United States wants to crush Lebanon. It wants to destroy the social fabric in order to bring down the resistance against Israel so that Israel can dominate. It's a tool, the sanctions that the Americans use across the world. They crush nations, they crush people. If you don't see it in the news, it's not something that's dramatic. People die quietly, whether it's Venezuela or Cuba or Libya or Yemen, through the barbaric starvation siege that the Americans helped the Saudis impose. And they did it in Iraq. If you remember, during Saddam Hussein, the Saddam Hussein that they created and gave chemical weapons to, later on they sanctioned Iraq because of the Saddam Hussein that they created. And when 500,000 children had died because of the sanctions, the U.S. Secretary of State said, it's worth it. So this is not new. These tactics, these policies are not new. The Americans know exactly what they're doing. They are brutal, they are barbaric, they're inhumane. But they are the norm, and the very fact that the Western media really doesn't say anything about this shows that Western countries don't have a free media. Okay. They're all controlled by the powers that be.
Okay. Well, Elijah, what do you think? You heard Mohammed said basically the U.S. is implementing policy that it does all over. I want to look at that aspect, because it just seems that if that's the case, it's a copy-paste type of scenario. Trying to create failed states, as Mohammed said, throughout the region and beyond. It just seems that there would be lessons that people would learn from other states, because we see inside of Lebanon there are some various groups that either buy into what is being said, or because they perhaps benefit from the suffering itself. What do you make of that side of things, and what needs to be done? I mean, Said Hassan Nasrallah talked tonight about basically it's not one group, or it's not Hezbollah that's being targeted, but all of the Lebanese people. So they are all in it together.
Absolutely. What the Americans are doing is trying to break the back of the axis of the resistance by economic sanction and pushing the state of Lebanon, Syria, even Iraq and Iran into a failed state. But because they have failed militarily in breaking Hezbollah in 2006, breaking Syria in 2011, and Iraq in 2014, and they want to divide the country, and also imposing the harshest sanction on Iran, so they changing their style into sanction now to starve the population. But what they are doing is, in some places like in Lebanon, is turning against the Americans, because the Americans have friends in every country where the axis of the resistance is deployed and exists, where there is a society that formed this axis of the resistance. However, the more the Americans are tightening the rope again around the neck of the member of the axis of the resistance, the more this axis of the resistance in finding other ways to come out and take the benefit of these sanctions and these harsh period, and turning them into positive opportunity. So we see the solidarity among the axis of the resistance that is very important in this case. And thanks to the Iranian support to Hezbollah in Lebanon Iran is sending one ship starting a few days ago, and then it's followed by other ships, as Sayyid Nasrallah said. That means the Iran is not leaving its the member of the Axis of the Resistance that represent part of his national security and part of this one nation that is standing against the U.S. hegemony and is trying to support Lebanon as best possible. Now, Iran is not going to substitute the country, the government, and is not going to be able to support another state. Exactly what Iran did in Syria. It has managed to make sure that the Syrian will not starve, and what it's trying now to do is managing to make sure that the Lebanese are not going to starve, and they're not going to just submit to what the Americans are doing, because the Americans want Hezbollah to deliver its weapon to serve Israel, so Israel can benefit from defeating Hezbollah when they fail to do that militarily. And I don't think this is going to happen, because now Hezbollah is gaining more popularity, because what Sayyid Nasrallah said, that the Iranian oil will be distributed to all hospitals regarding their religion or their belief, to all bakeries, to all the wherever there is an industry of a medical industry, and that will be distributed equally.
Okay.
Now, it's not going to be able to satisfy the population, but it's going to at least come out of this harsh sanction.
What about that, Mohammed? I mean, the leader of Hezbollah said that they talked about the fuel being brought in from Iran, and that it's not just one ship, but it's an opening to a whole new path. And he also talked about people being wrong about these international sanctions on Iran. He says these are unilateral, illegal U.S. sanctions that are illegal, and people have to think beyond that. Your take on this whole act with Iran and sending fuel, tell me about the importance of that and perhaps being able to break this whole hegemonic control that these certain Western states think that they have in this region.
If one reads the Western media or watches Western media outlets, one would think that these are indeed international sanctions, but they're only American sanctions. But I think that is a part of Eurocentricism. That's their racism kicking in. That's their exceptionalism kicking in, where they think that if they, the Europeans, the Americans, the Australians, the New Zealanders, if they impose sanctions, that means the world has imposed sanctions, because they are the international community. That's how they see the world. That's how they view themselves. That's how they call themselves the civilized world and the rest of us the uncivilized world. They call themselves the free world and the rest of us the unfree world. But the free world is not going to hear anything about the atrocities being committed by their own armies, by their own soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, and the way in which they're crushing the populations of Cuba or Venezuela through sanctions, or Iran for that matter, preventing Iran from importing masks, preventing Iran from importing vaccines and the equipment to produce vaccines. They're not going to hear that, because the free world doesn't give that sort of information to their public. So we should expect nothing but this sort of representation, this sort of narrative building in the West, where Western sanctions or American sanctions are universal sanctions. No, these are sanctions imposed by the Godfather, the United States being the global Godfather, and the Iranians are not going to accept that. And the Iranians broke the sanctions imposed by the Godfather against Venezuela. They did it against Syria. Now they're going to do it against Lebanon, because this is one of the best ways to defeat American hegemony, to show that these sanctions can be broken and that the Americans cannot do anything about it. That encourages other powers like China and Russia to do the same on other fronts.
Well, Elijah, as Said Hassan says, pointed the finger at the American embassy in Lebanon as the main culprit, trying to destabilize Lebanon. Let's talk about the role of what's supposed to be a diplomatic entity, but basically trying to cause chaos. And of course, Sayed Hassan even talked about goal being civil war in Lebanon.
The American see like a country, and like the decision maker in the country, to the point that the American ambassador just phoned the president to tell him about a new plan to drag gas from Egypt and Jordan through Syria and to Lebanon, just as a reaction to what Sayed Nasrallah said about the Iranian and diesel oil tankers that are coming to Lebanon. And by communicating that via phone without showing any documents or any plan or any thoughtful ideas, the Americans are, first of all, just dealing extremely rudely with the president of Lebanon. Secondly, just not asking Syria its opinion, notwithstanding the Caesar Act that imposed sanctions on Syria, and how this plan is going to be materialized. Thirdly, this plan, if materialized, needs a year, which means the Lebanese population should wait for the blessing of the American to receive their gasoline, and all that forwarded by the U.S. Embassy in Lebanon. So it's like acting like the decision maker in the country, but reacting really surprisingly lightly as an ambassador. And I think what is really driving the American off the hook is because Sayed Nasrallah and Iran are spoiling the plan of the U.S. to starve the population and to turn their guns against Hezbollah and to blame Hezbollah for the dear situation in the country, when the ally of the U.S., the corrupted ally of the U.S., are the source of the situation and the financial crisis. So, yes, the Americans are behaving like they are the decision maker in the country.
Spoiling the plans of the United States is what Elijah said, Muhammad. I think that's probably the main problem that the United States has with the Islamic Republic of Iran. And now if we look at the resistance front, we see that pressure has been increased across the axis. But at the same time, we don't see any part of the resistance acquiescing. I mean, what exactly does that say? What message does that send to the United States and its allies?
The most important thing is that it shows that the members of this alliance or this axis of resistance, they're not proxies. These are people who have a mutual belief, a similar ideological understanding of how things are in the world today. They're anti-imperialist. They're anti-American hegemony. They want the Americans off their backs, whether it's in Yemen or Syria or Iraq or Lebanon or Palestine or Afghanistan or Iraq. The United States has built an empire and has manipulated the people of the region for many decades, and the Europeans before the Americans. So the West as a whole has been a very destructive force in this region, just like everywhere else in the world. And therefore, no matter how much pressure the Americans impose on the populations, even though there are going to be people who side with the Americans, these elites or these business people or these westernized figures in each society will advocate American policy, the bulk of these societies know what the United States stands for. It stands for oppression, it stands for injustice, and it stands for hierarchy.
Okay, I'm going to have to just jump in here because I'm going to throw it back at Elijah just for the last minute. Now, Elijah, many would say that the main problem for Washington and its allies is actually that the resistance is stronger than ever, both inside of Lebanon and beyond. And it's in a situation now, they're in a situation that they will do anything possible to stop this wave of the axis of resistance. Your take in 1 minute.
I don't think it's. I think it's too late for the Americans to do anything to stop the course of the path of the axis of the resistance. I think Americans are on their way out from West Asia. They've left Afghanistan humiliated. They're going to do that in Iraq, and they're going to fail in Lebanon dramatically, as they are failing in Gaza with their Israeli ally. And they're exactly failing again in Syria, even if they're starving the population. I think the determination of the axis of the resistance is much stronger, and the occupier is destiny is only to the dustbin of history.
And on that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on this spotlight. Elijah McNair, a journalist and political analyst out of Brussels, and right here in Tehran, professor of international studies from the University of Tehran, Mohammad Marandi. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains. Close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is the camping mat, the flashlight,
And these are the trekking poles. As you may have guessed, I'm packing my backpack for a hiking trip. I'm really excited because my trip is to one of the very beautiful regions of Iran, to Nehor Lake in Ardabil province. Nehor Lake is a lake located at the borderline of two provinces of Gilan and Ardabil. This lake is situated 48 kilometers southeast of Ardabil along Khalkhal route in one of the valleys of Baghru mountain. This lake is at the altitude of 2,500 meters above the sea level. Nehor Lake consists of a smaller and a larger lake that get connected in spring, forming a single lake. The average depth of this lake reaches 5 meters. Nehor Lake is a natural freshwater lake. Enough precipitation and abundant springs have made this lake a permanent one. This region has a wide variety of terrestrial and aquatic plants. This lake has ecological, ecotourism, beekeeping, livestock, and agricultural values. The Nehor Lake is also home to some species of migratory birds. Hunting any bird in this lake is illegal. What a punishing path Nehor Lake has! Oh, this slope ends in the lake. I can hardly breathe. I have to take a rest. Oh my God, Nehor Lake. Looks like a beautiful postcard. It's green as far as the eye could see. This lake looks like a blue gem which shines in the middle of a meadow. Let's get closer to see what's happening there. I am now beside Nehor Lake. Nature travelers have camped outside around the lake. On the other side of the lake, where it seems to be calm, some people are fishing. Because of being a freshwater lake, Nehor has provided a highly suitable habitat for the fish. In late summer, fishing competitions are held in this region. However, as a nature traveler, I am against the idea of any kind of hunting or fishing. Oh, look! How many horses are here? How beautiful they are! One of them is with black spots. Reminds me of Rakhsh, Rostam's horse. As you know, Rostam is one of the heroes of Iranian legends. Here you can hire a horse and go horseback riding around the lake. The mud in some parts of the Nero Lake is swampy, and that is why swimming is forbidden in this lake. What a cold weather! I'd better wear my jacket before I catch a cold. Until next time, goodbye!
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.